This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The problem is that we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology, and it's terrifically dangerous. It's now approaching a point of crisis overall. And until we understand ourselves, until we answer those huge questions of philosophy that the philosophers abandoned a couple generations ago, where do we come from, who are we, and where are we going? Until we address those rationally, we are running a very dangerous course.
The famous biologist E.O. Wilson said that at Harvard in 2009, "We like to think we are self-directed, but we live in a world beyond our control. Something big is going on, and we don't know what it is. If it breaks, we may not know how to fix it." Dr. Nate Hagen spent the last decade searching for the big picture questions and answers. Around the year 2000, he dropped out of managing very big money on Wall Street. He became a popular speaker on the study of resources and peak oil. Hagen started teaching at university, and now he's discovered a new life form built out of humans, the superorganism. He can see a different path for humanity, but maybe only after a crash of our financial system. Nate has a master's degree in finance from the University of Chicago and a PhD in natural resources from the University of Vermont. He's a board member of the Post-Carbon Institute and belongs to other groups like the Bottleneck Foundation. Nate teaches a popular course called Reality 101, A Survey of the Human Predicament, to graduate students at the University of Minnesota. Those lectures are becoming books and videos and more. We last talked with Nate on Radio EcoShock in February 2016. Nate Hagens, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Good to be back. Good morning.
All right. So are you a former peak oil guy, or does that problem continue even after the fracking revolution?
Well, we only have an hour. That might take 20 minutes, but here's the short version. Peak oil was a horrible name for that concept. It should have been called peak benefits, because if we're allowed to issue credit and monetary claims, we can't create energy, but we can create money to access a more expensive tranche of energy. And that's what's been going on. Eventually, there will be a peak. The world would have peaked without shale oil. Conventional oil, the cheap stuff, has been on a 12-year plateau, and we've been able to maintain and exceed the total amount of oil just by issuing more and more financial credit. Oil will peak probably soon, and that has big implications. The more relevant issue, Alex, is that oil is not the same all over the world. Some of it is higher quality. We've used and found and used most of the easy, less environmentally damaging oil. And what's left, there's a lot of it, but it's dirtier, it depletes faster, and it's more costly to get out. So, yes, peak oil is still a real phenomenon. And paradoxically, 12 years after it was very popularized, no one's really talking about it because they psychologically think that it's been debunked. It hasn't.
And with your record on peak oil and some environmentalism, giving a lecture in Saudi Arabia sounds like going into the lion's den. How did that presentation come about, and what were your impressions of the reception of your ideas by the Saudi audience?
Yeah, I was invited there by Tad Patzick, who's a longtime friend. He is a professor there. I'd never been to the Middle East before. You know, I was in King Abdullah University for Science and Technology, which is its own kind of 40-mile mirage with fenced barriers and everything. I wasn't really in the country of Saudi Arabia, just at this university outpost. I loved it. The people there were warm and inviting, very intellectual. That's one of the richest universities in the world. But what I was most impressed by is, you know, I spoke to 600 people. There were Germans and Brazilians and Japanese and Americans and people from Russia and all over country in the Middle East, and they were all concerned about our collective future. And when we talk about science, when we talk about the environment and the future of Earth's ecosystems, we're kind of all one race. And you could see it in meetings like that, that transcend kind of our tribal, political, national boundaries. So that kind of took me by surprise in a positive way.
You suggest modern life is in fact a living thing, a superorganism whose cells are humans. Could you talk to us about that? What is it?
Yeah, it's not a real biological organism, but it's functioning like one. So we, for 290,000 years of human history, which is the bulk of human history, we were just functioning as hunter-gatherer bands around the world, very small population. And then the climate stabilized. It warmed and it stabilized, and that allowed agriculture to begin in no fewer than seven places around the planet around 10 to 12,000 years ago. And that changed our economic organization because we started to stay in one place and generate economic surplus in the form of grain, which meant that not everyone in the tribe needed to work to get food anymore. So we had surplus to trade and to have different occupations. And we ended up, for worse, not for better, working a lot more, and our health deteriorated, but we started to grow. And that was the dawn of capitalism, as it were. And you fast forward through that agricultural revolution until the industrial revolution, when we started farming vertically as well as horizontally. We went under the ground to find ancient solar productivity to add to our ecosystems. So what's happened isn't the fault of anyone. It wasn't a conscious thing that we planned to do. But right now, the global human enterprise is that we're maximizing quarterly earnings via our personal economies, our small businesses, our corporations, and even our nation states. And in doing so, when we maximize earnings, all of our economic goods and services are linked to energy. They're 99.3% historically correlated with energy. If we generate 100 new units of GDP, we're going to use at least 99 new units of energy. And that energy, as you well aware, is 85% correlated with fossil energy. And so what we're doing is there's this emergent property that comes from humans in large groups that we're just all of us pursuing, coordinating, cooperating towards this GDP, these quarterly earnings. And downstream from that is all of the waste and the CO2 and the environmental impacts and human social impacts as well. But no one's trying to do this. It's just an emergent effect of 7.7 billion humans collaborating towards economic surplus. So that is termed a superorganism. And the reason it's not a real organism is a real superorganism is self-regulating. And so the criticism could be made that, look at our CO2, a real superorganism wouldn't have that amount of waste because it's killing the host. But we are self-regulating. We're just self-regulating the growth part. So we're just doing anything we can to keep the whole system growing. And so with that viewpoint, humans en masse, you know, we are phenotypically primates, but behaviorally, at least in large groups, we are acting more like the social insects. And termites or ants create giant nests and termite mounds and things like that, and giant superhighways under the ground, which they have no architects for. It's that superhighway. You can watch videos online to see these ant super colonies underground where they pour cement down in there and then they archaeologically dig it all away, and you can see these massive, intricate highways. There's no engineer that creates those. That also is the ants just following this giant social signal to get food, and that's what is the result. The same thing as humans is we have a 17 terawatt metabolism of a global economy, which is all of us pursuing economic growth in the current cultural backdrop.
our civilization, well, Tim Garrett called it a heat engine, and it seems like our purpose is almost to burn as much carbon as we can, as fast as we can, and the side effect of that, if you will, is to heat up the Earth and give us a whole new system. How do you look at that?
I know Tim, and I agree that his constant, at least, has held true the last 50 years, but I kind of disagree with the logic of how he gets there. I think GDP is extremely correlated with energy, and that's a finding that's been 50 years known by biophysical economists. He goes and takes it a step further and looks at wealth, which is historical currency added up to now, and says that our wealth has a memory, which will require more energy next year. And there's where I disagree with that, because if you spend $1 million for a rich kid's birthday party in Vancouver next year, there will be no energy memory of that. There will be a memory if there's a factory in Vancouver making things. So if there's an economic collapse brought about by a financial recalibration or some problem in currency, I think Tim's constant will no longer hold true. But Tim's absolutely right with his conclusions that de facto we are functioning as a heat engine, at least as long as growth continues. And I would correct one thing you just said. I don't think it's our purpose. I think it's the effect. And I think we have figured out via science and the Renaissance and the 300 years of figuring out who we are, where we came from, how we got here. Now we're actually figuring out the whole story, which is a reference to E.O. Wilson's quote earlier. We know who we are, how we got here, what we're doing, what our impacts are, but more importantly, what we really need and what is available to us. And so I think we have a chance to have a different purpose this century as we become more culturally aware of the stakes. Our real purpose as individuals is to essentially seek the same emotional states as our ancestors, which we currently do in a variety of behaviors in a novel, resource, and technology-rich culture. But the purpose of our culture is to self-organize in a way that provides those feelings and experiences for the individual that comprise the culture. So we can and should change our cultural purpose in coming decades, in my opinion, quite simply in a way to get the same neurotransmitter cocktails and feelings that we evolved to seek using less resources and environmental damage. And that can be done, but I think it would require a future interview to discuss. When we get to talking about human purpose, it's kind of a weird thing because, you know, just like I said, truthfully, I think people think our purpose is to make money or to go to heaven. And we've arrived at a point of our species where we figured out how we got here and what we're doing, and that's really not our purpose. I think we have to live up to our Latin name, Homo sapiens, which is wise man. Right now, we're more pan ignis, which is fire ape, and I think we can aspire to something more than what we've arrived at in the early 21st century. I don't think climate change is the problem. I think climate change is a symptom of the problem of billions of humans acting in their self-interest, creating this energy-eating superorganism. And the answers to that, the answers to most of our things, are a new economic system. And the new economic system, we're not going to just vote to make it happen. It's going to happen during crisis. So we have to have blueprints and constituency and, before those, we need understanding of what's going on to kind of shift the course of the default. Because the default is we're going to have a financial crash, and we can talk about the logic of that. And then if nothing else happens, we're just going to rebuild the same superorganism from a smaller level and access the lower quality tranches of fossil carbon and other things and you know, repeat the mistakes that we did on the way up.
Well, that's the way we do it. We're humans. No, I'm joking. I think we can make some changes, and I hope we can. And we will talk about that more as we go along. Now, you have said in another talk that capitalism did not choose the superorganism as a vehicle for itself, but really it was the other way around. So I'm wondering, is your vision in some respects anti-business or anti-corporate?
Well, corporations are miniature superorganisms, right? You could have the nicest man or woman as CEO who cares about the oceans, who cares about five generations from now, who wants to do triple bottom line things. But if in doing so, in being that person, detracts from quarterly earnings, that person will be replaced. The head of that miniature organism will be replaced with someone else that can maximize quarterly earnings. So regarding capitalism, animals are investors as well, Alex. If a lion spends some energy to get a gazelle, there's a caloric investment and a caloric payoff. So this idea of surplus originated in biology, in nature. So capitalism is the combination of a lot of organisms pursuing energy surplus, but in our case, it's financial surplus as a marker for energy. And then we do that globally, so there's cultural approval of this dynamic. And we also have, in the United States and in Canada, 100-to-1 exosomatic surplus with which to work. So most organisms in nature, they don't have any exosomatic surplus. They go and invest their calories in predation, and they get some prey, and they eat it until they're hungry again. So it's 1-for-1. We in the United States consume around 3,000 calories a day, but a lot of it's wasted, so we actually only eat 2,200 calories a day. But we use 220,000 calories a day worth of energy. So capitalism is this emergent process that happened and was turbocharged when we have this massive amount of fossil calories that we're adding to our system. You know, it kind of self-perpetuates as we're growing. And I don't know that capitalism can exist after growth. Certainly we're going to have to, and I mean have to, like we will not have a choice, choose something other than GDP as our goal in the future. Because to increase GDP year over year in the next 20 to 30 years will not be possible.
Radio EcoShock. If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Nate Hagans from the University of Minnesota and author of the book, The Bottlenecks of the 21st Century, Essays on the System Synthesis of the Human Predicament. Well, Nate, the stock market just keeps going up and up. Apparently, it can never go down. And you have a degree in finance. You worked in Wall Street with names like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, who, by the way, both went extinct. Why are you so negative about our future these days financially when things are going so well in the market?
First of all, I never worked at Bear Stearns. I got a job offer from them. I never would have accepted a job there. I worked at Salomon Brothers, not Bear Stearns, just to be clear.
Okay.
Yeah. So I still have a lot of friends from my Wall Street days, and it's very interesting talking to them about the risks. I would say every single one of my Wall Street friends, who I'm still friends with because half of them were sociopaths and I am no longer friends with them, but the ones that I talk to regularly, they all understand that we are in a financial, very tenuous situation and that central banks have taken over the model of commercial banks of providing liquidity to the system and that it's not going to end well. But the difference between my view and theirs is predominantly they still believe that human ingenuity and technology are the main drivers of human wealth and productivity, where I think both of those things are very important, but the main driver is extracting low entropy energy and resources, particularly liquid fuels like oil and gas. And so that's the one thing is there's a disconnect on they just think that the markets will sell off and they will be able to game that somehow. And then the second thing is they're unaware of oil depletion and the fact that in North America we've used everything but the source rock and shale is all we have left and it costs $60 a barrel to get out and that's where the market price is. So we've used most of our really low cost energy. So I think the financial sector, the people that I went to business school with, are generally energy blind. They don't view the world from an energy and resource lens. Then the second thing, which is a little depressing, is that even if they understood what I just told you, I truly believe half of them wouldn't even care. And that's the other thing, is there's an empathy that's lacking in our culture today, that this addiction to quarterly earnings. And, you know, I have friends who are multimillionaires that are looking at what's going on with Iran, looking at what's going on with Australia, looking at what's going on with social inequality and some of the other things, and they're just trying to position their millions so that they can increase them a little bit. And it's a little disgusting to me and sad, but it's that's where we are in this culture.
When I was looking at your work, I thought, you know, I'll bet you there's some bright kid coming out of Harvard Business School who's going to go through your work and figure out a way to make money out of that.
Yeah, I think, well, there's a lot of ways to make money off of my work if you read between the lines. But we're at a place right now. Remember the movie The Graduate, where Dustin Hoffman at the end gets some advice from some older person who says, I got one word for you, plastics. And now we're approaching a time, an era of our culture where it's the one word isn't plastics, it's the impact from plastics or any number of things like that. We've now gone beyond our own small little sphere, and our downstream impacts of the superorganism are slowly but inexorably killing our home, which is Earth. And so I really hope that people with money, people with financial capital, are able to see two or three steps down the road and start using that financial capital while they can in a pro-social, pro-future way, because there's a lot of things to do on that. Here's the problem that I've encountered numerous times, Alex, is you meet with these people who are very high status, very successful, very smart, and you spend years trying to educate them about how this whole story fits together, how an ambitious primate, us, came across this bolus of fossil sunlight, and we created this gargantuan wealth and productivity, you know, 15 times the goods and services per capita as we had 200 years ago, et cetera. But this is going away and there's plenty of it left, but not to live at this sort of lifestyle. And they push back and they push back and they say, that can't be true. Technology will solve it. And we've heard this before. And Thomas Malthus and Paul Ehrlich, blah, blah, blah. And eventually they're like, oh my God, Nate, you're right. Well, we're screwed. There's nothing we can do. I'm just going to go live in the Bahamas or whatever. And the moment between there's no problem and we're screwed is like an hour. And so we really need to populate that middle space where people understand there's a problem, but not all futures are equivalent. There are still many very good futures on the table. It's just that the human brain likes certainty. And I'm certain there's no problem feels the same as I'm certain there's no solution, because what they have in common is it means that you don't have to do anything. In both of those cases. Well, we do have to do something, and a lot of us have to do something. So, yeah, I do think there are a lot of people at Harvard, in business schools, in undergraduate colleges, in high schools around the world that recognize something is wrong. They just don't have a cohesive narrative of what it is that's wrong. And so I think there's a hell of a lot of noise versus signal out there.
In one of your works, you suggest we need to apply what we learned in the last 30 years to the next 30 years. Do you really think either the financial system or the environment we need will give us another 30 years to kind of figure things out and then act?
Yeah, well, the reason I said that is because the paper you read, Economics for the Future Beyond the Superorganism, was for a 30-year anniversary issue of the founding of the field of ecological economics. So we wanted to look at the 30-year timeline. Yeah, I actually think what we do in the next decade is gonna determine the future. and the decades after that, but the next decade is critical. And I don't think we're going to degrow voluntarily. I think the degrowth will happen as, you know, you talked about the stock market at all-time highs and oil's only $60 a barrel. Those are symptoms of a broken system, because we're using finance to obfuscate the fact that we've used finance for 50 years to paper over our limits. And we keep creating credit to allow us to consume things today that we otherwise wouldn't be able to consume. And as long as we can do that, things seem okay. But in order to do that, central banks need to provide liquidity. China right now, 23% of this year's GDP was just created directly out of thin air. That's a massive, massive amount of credit. And that, of course, increases the demand for things like oil globally. So I don't think we're going to say, you know what, that Alex and Nate's conversation makes a lot of sense. Let's just tighten our belts and have a smaller economy. It's not going to happen that way. It's definitely not going to happen in the way that a lot of climate activists are advocating to keep it in the ground. Because keeping it in the ground is keeping, I don't know if I said this on the last interview, but one barrel of oil does 4.5 years of yours and mine physical work, and we use 100 billion barrel of oil equivalents of the three main fossil fuels per year. So we have effectively 500 billion human equivalent labors in the form of fossil oil, coal, and natural gas. We can't just leave that in the ground. Our economies would not only collapse, but like almost disappear. That can't happen. That won't happen. But what's going to happen is we won't be able to continue to grow enough. See, when money is created, the interest on the money is not created. So we have to grow because our institutions require growth, and we have to grow because we have to pay the interest back on what came before. And eventually, all the central banks in the world, unless we have some new miracle technology that is some $10 a barrel oil at 100 million barrels per year scale, we're not going to be able to continue to grow this amount of financial claims. And then we have some sort of a musical chair scenario where we have too many financial claims for the amount of physical resources that exist. And so we have a deflation, we have lower prices, we have lots of unemployed people, more poverty, probably some geopolitical issues. But it's at that moment that it's not only a threat and a risk that we need to prepare for, but it's also the opportunity of this century to kind of steer the superorganism wearing a muzzle of sorts, where we can have caps and floors and new economic policies and supporting the things that actually contribute to human and environmental well-being and taxing the bad things. For instance, one valid idea would be at that moment when prices are going to be very low because of an economic depression, that's when we tax not only carbon, but all non-renewables like phosphorus or copper or anything that we pull out of the ground that's finite. And at the same time, people are going to be unemployed and we're going to be in a depression. We remove the tax on humans. We remove income tax. And so immediately then, people have more money than they did from the same job. But things that are intensively using non-renewable resources are much more costly. And then that in itself sends a signal within the economy to better allocate things in a more sustainable way. But there's no freaking way we could do that today, because it just politically would be a lead balloon.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Nate Higgins. We are talking about the big system spinning out of control and maybe what a new economics could look like. I noticed that instead of talking about a financial breakdown or collapse, you prefer the term recalibration. But I wonder, it may not be that we go down a ramp of developing circumstances and then we hit a wall. We may hit a wall fairly quick. I mean, if, for example, there's a cyber war and Iran or Russia decides to shut down our servers, our daily lives are totally controlled and dependent on digital technology, even our food coming through the grocery stores. So I wonder, maybe an outside force will cause a financial reset of this superorganism.
Yeah, there's a few metaphors in there you combined. I think when, if you talk to professional risk experts, you're right. We have a lot of risks. There is pathogen risks. There's cyber risks. There's geopolitical risk. There's financial risk. And if you have enough of those risks, they become kind of a singularity that something will eventually happen. I think, you know, we have to remember that it sounds like a collapse, but a 30% drop in GDP would bring North American economies back to the 1990s. A 50% drop in GDP would bring us back to the 1970s. And it ain't going to be pretty, but it's also not, you know, end times or Armageddon. We've just lived beyond our means for two generations and a bill is coming due. Which is why with my students, you know, at the end of the semester, it's a sledgehammer of information about our economies and fossil carbon and the environment, not only climate change, but species loss and what's happening with the insects and the oceans and everything else. The students are kind of expecting me on the what to do section at the end is to go solar or be a vegetarian, or drive an electric car. My recommendations to them are none of those things, other than if those things are, philosophically aesthetic along with their own individual ethic. Everything that I tell them is about brain and behavior and being mentally and physically resilient, understanding that the best things in life are free. We have, as a culture, replaced social capital and community with technology and money, and we're about to undo that that trade over time. And I think, you know, we can focus on the scary aspects of grocery stores stopping and a cyber warfare and those unlikely scenarios, when the real scenario is we're probably going to have a Great Depression, things are going to self-organize around energy, and people are going to be resilient and respond and cooperate, at least initially. And so I think we need healthy minds. We certainly need people to think from the heart, not only from the head, and different models of community resilience. And so I think in the scenarios of the future, personally, I think this financial recalibration is going to happen within 5 ± 4 years, so between 1 and 9 years from now. And the reason I say recalibration and not collapse is at the moment of a financial recalibration, of a financial, like, oh, my God, we can't bail out these countries or institutions because we don't have anyone big enough to bail them out, this musical chair scenario, but at that moment, all of the factories, all of the energy, all of the knowledge, all of the technology, all of the infrastructure still exists. So at that moment, as long as we, you know, keep things organized and have some plans, that is the first step towards a smaller, more sapient economy. But, you know, everything I view about the future is under an imaginary probability distribution in my head, because I think that's the correct way to look at the future. So are there some really nasty scenarios under there? Yes, but I don't think they're the most likely ones. Same with climate change. I think, you know, the benign climate scenarios are now off the table. We're headed for clearly 1 degree. Probably 1.5 degree, maybe 2 degree. That's now built in. But I think some of the really Armageddon climate scenarios are also off the table because the IPCC modelers were energy blind and we just don't have that amount of carbon. But I think behaviorally, we're not going to do anything as a culture about climate change. Look at the last 40 years of conferences and agreements and everything. And meanwhile, 2018 was the highest emissions in history, highest CO2 in 3 million years. We're just not going to do anything because we require energy to grow. But once this kind of recalibration, which brought more broadly, I call the great simplification. Once that happens, that's an opportunity to have models ahead of time, pilots of people living differently, using less. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty surrounding that, which is why what I'm trying to do right now is get general awareness in communities across North America. I mean, we have 3,000 some communities that have climate action plans. We have zero that have economic resilience plans for a great simplification sort of event. So I think first and foremost, we really need different tribes of people to start talking to each other about the things that really matter. I don't know about where you live, but where I live, the left doesn't talk to the right. And there's certain buzzwords, climate change being one of them, that if you mention that, you stop a conversation. And yet the people that live within 30 miles of me ultimately all care about the same thing. We care about peace and healthy food and water and good schools for our children and music and beer. The best things in life are free once we have basic needs covered. And I think we're in this giant Rube Goldberg machine as a culture, and we've lost sight of those simple things. But I think there's this underlying sense in the zeitgeist that this is our reality, even though a lot of people don't know all these details. People feel this. But I'm very worried about the social fabric before I am really the financial or environmental. Because people, at least in the United States, are just not talking to each other across the aisle at all.
Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Nate Higgins. We are talking about the big system spinning out of control and maybe what a new economics could look like. And you have been talking about this all through the interview, how the recalibration could be a blessing in disguise, pushing us into the birth of a new systems economics. And I don't know the term systems economics. Where does that come from and how do you use that?
Well, I think I may have seen that before, I don't know, but I made that up for this paper. I used it to differentiate it from ecological economics, and I have a PhD in ecological economics, but I really have become unenamored with the field because what ecological economics does is it tries to put prices on nature, and then therefore we'll make better decisions. And I just don't think you can put a price on nature. And it doesn't realize this superorganism dynamic, which had its seeds planted at the agricultural revolution. This is the problem. This is the problem. How? Because this thing has become a thing unto itself. And we could try to maim it or hobble it, or what I expect is it's going to run out of food soon, and then we're going to have to respond. So a systems economics would be advised by, we don't need all this energy and stuff to be happy, Alex. The average American uses now 20 times the energy as the average Filipino, yet subjective well-being studies say that Filipinos are just as happy as Americans. Why is that? It's because they're surrounded by people that are in their same situation. So community and shared privation in their case and all the other social aspects of who we are as a species, the Filipinos are getting that. Now, I'm not telling Americans that they need to live like Filipinos. I'm just saying that we care much more as biological organisms about relative comparisons versus absolute comparisons. So we care about more versus less, much more than we care about a little versus a lot. And that actually is a big silver lining for our future, because if we're poorer in energy and resource terms, but everyone is poorer in energy and resource terms, And at the same time, we have our basic needs covered, the environment is protected, we could be having a lot less damage on our fellow man and on the environment, but our well-being is actually higher. So we have to look at the drivers. I mean, all of this, we have ecological problems, we have environmental problems, we have social problems, we have energy problems. They all originate from a single problem, which is the mismatch of the human brain with our ancestral environment and our modern energy and technology-rich environment. And so we can use that knowledge to make better structures for how our communities, et cetera, would do things differently in a lower throughput environment. But it's not going to be easy, because the reason that the conversation I'm having with you is not more widespread isn't because it's so complicated. It's because, could you imagine the G20 or the OECD sitting around saying, oh yeah, growth is over, we're going to have a smaller pie for the first time in 100 years instead of a bigger pie? They can't have that conversation, because then what would it mean? Who gets the piece of the smaller pie? As long as this pie is growing, we can all get a piece of it. But if the pie is shrinking, that does a phase shift in our mind of scarcity, and that changes the conversation. So I don't think the things that you and I are talking about right now are ever going to be in the national discourse until 10 or 20 years after they become obvious to anyone. And not only that, but as a biological species, one of my core points is that we care immensely more about the present than the future via something called a steep discount rate, or the vernacular would be called time bias. And the more addicted someone is to technology and immediate stimulation, the steeper that dynamic is. And so if you can really understand that, if you really internalize that, you know that we will not do anything as a culture ahead of a crisis. And if you really feel that, that in itself becomes motivating for you as an individual and you as a leader in your community to use these last years of growth in the economies fueled by central banks and credit and other things, to use that opportunity as preparation to do things different physically, psychologically, in your community. First and foremost in your community is get to know other people, because if you have nodes of social capital and communication, that is going to be one of the most important things that doesn't exist right now. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, systems economics looks at the entire picture. We can no longer have a bunch of experts in a room talking about one of them ocean acidification, another one sociology, another one energy. You have to kind of understand these things all in a single mind and then get a bunch of those minds together, because we're part of a system and you have to see the whole system. Otherwise, none of the suggestions or mitigations make sense. Yeah, so if there was a benevolent alien looking down on our planet, our situation, he or she or it might observe the following. On a long-term basis, we clearly, our biggest risk is the carbon pulse, that we're emitting vast amounts of CO2, 10 million times faster than it was sequestered, far, far more rapidly for ecosystems to absorb in a healthy way. And so that is the biggest existential risk from a bird's eye or alien's eye view. But from a human behavior, biological organism, self-organizing societal view, that same carbon pulse is what's helping us with armies of 500 billion fossil workers every year. We don't want to get rid of that, because changing that, getting rid of the carbon benefits.
Thinking about your work, Nate, I ended up watching a video of a 2009 Harvard debate between biologist E.O. Wilson and his longtime academic competitor, James D. Watson, the molecular biologist. And Watson said, why try to ask questions that we can't answer? He said that's a waste of time. We should look for questions we can solve, like curing cancer. I wonder, Nate, if you are working on questions that no single human can answer, but you don't like big groups or institutions to answer it either.
Oh, I would love big groups and institutions to answer this. In fact, I think this is the calling of our time, is to get a lot of people, at least if they squint, they can see this new game board. The game board looks like chess, and the pieces look like they're chess pieces, but the rules have totally changed. And if you have an energy, human behavior, and ecological lens, even a 19-year-old playing this new game can beat the former Harvard economist chess masters of the prior era. So I think these problems can't be solved, in the sense that we can't continue economic growth for 8 billion humans and keep climate under 2 degrees and save the 5,500 remaining mammal species and live like the average person in British Columbia in terms of energy and throughput. But there are many potential futures that are still on the table that are pretty good outcomes this century. And so we need institutions to start to at least psychologically become aware of this. They're not going to do anything right now because they can't, because their job descriptions, working at these corporations, working at these government agencies, working at these institutions, working at the City Council of Vancouver, their job description precludes them from acting on what I'm telling you. But if they psychologically understand the central importance of energy to our lives, the fact that we don't need all this stuff to be happy, the fact that we're part of a system, the fact that growth period, that for most of the last 10,000 years, we had very tiny growth, if no growth at all. And only the 20th century was this spectacular unicorn in our species history. And yet that's the century that we were all alive in. So it seems like this is the natural thing, but it's not. So if we start inoculating people about these issues, and we have superheroes locally that want to do something in their lives that pays it forward for the future, and they take leadership roles in preparing and doing things in different communities, and we have that in hundreds or thousands of communities, I think that acts as a bridge to something that we don't know yet, how we're going to respond. Remember, we are still, even if we had a 30% drop in GDP in North America, we would still be among the three richest generations in the history of our species, energy and material-wise. So we have to keep things in perspective. I don't know that this problem has an answer, but it has millions of miniature solutions that themselves could create an emergent property that I have no idea what it would look like.
And I ask myself, why is Nate Higgins striving for the really big picture now? Is it because as you age, you want to wrap up your work? Is it something that's driving deep inside you? Or is it because we need it desperately and somebody has to try? What are your thoughts?
I think it's a little of both. I think I was always, my parents tell me this, even when I was 3 and 4 years old, I was super curious about things. I would ask questions and I was really interested in the natural world, and I would always be on the lookout for animals, and I was just a curious person. Well, now I want to understand the truth. I care more about being, knowing the truth than I care about being correct about the truth. And it's taken me 10 years to figure out this is how credit, energy, economic growth, human behavior, ecology, climate change, species loss fit together. And I'm sure I have some things wrong around the edges, but I think if you squint and look forward, the conceptual framework that I've created is going to hold its shape over the next decade or two. And I think we need people to see this shape in order to make better decisions going forward. So, what I've been able to do is connect with the best ecologists and psychiatrists and neuroscientists and energy people around the world and take the best of their thinking and add it to this framework. But if you think about it, who in our society can make a living off being a generalist? And I think the only answer is a hedge fund manager or a librarian or a teacher, because most people have to be experts They have to be an attorney or a tax lawyer or a real estate developer or an engineer. And what we face now is we have to fly up high enough and look down with a bird's eye view and see how the pieces fit together. But it's taken me 15 years to do that, Alex. And the truth is, I wish I could have spent half of that time advising people what to do. But when you go and talk to someone and they're like, well, I don't see any problems, you have to spend a lot of time and energy explaining these things. And now the real world has caught up to this framework a little bit. So all of a sudden, more people are listening. They're paying attention to this. They're begrudgingly agreeing. And now the big question that everyone's asking is, okay, I get it. What do we do? And so now I'm trying to populate the space with influential, bold, courageous people that kind of understand the choreography of what we face is we're probably going to face fiscal, financial chaos in the next decade, which itself is going to open up a space for new governance and new ideas. And we're going to need lots of things. You know, the general categories that I'm using is we're going to need speed bumps, which is to kind of slow and misdirect the metastasis of the human superorganism. We're going to need airbags, which is a category of social cohesion and social safety nets, preparation for a smaller economy. We're going to need blueprints, which is scientifically informed ideas on how communities and countries can go beyond GDP, because once this financial recalibration happens, we're going to probably decline after that even until we reach a stable level. Here's the other thing that's not happening along with the blueprints is almost all of the renewable energy conversations are that we're going to grow the economy using renewables and get rid of fossil fuels, which is just totally delusional. That's not going to happen. But what we can do is use a large percentage of stochastic renewable energy. I call it rebuildable energy because, you know, solar panels and wind turbines are at best rebuildable. They're not renewable. The sun and the wind are renewable. But what we can do is overbuild solar and wind, use the excess to create heavy fuels, which right now we can do, but it would cost $10 or $12 a gallon. So why would we do it when we can buy things for $2.50 a gallon? Well, why we would do it is because that still gives humans a massive energy to labor benefit that up until 100 years ago would have been indistinguishable from magic. But we're not doing it now because we're only looking at next quarter or next year's earnings. We're not thinking 10 or 20 years ahead when we have to use our remaining fossil carbon, hopefully not much coal, as seed corn to invest in this different economy. But those aren't the questions that we're asking right now. Everything is about growth and how to grow our economies using stochastic energy. So that's one of the things that falls under the blueprint category. And then the fourth category is loosely superheroes, which is to inspire people to play a role larger than their immediate self-interest and comfort to make the future better than the default. And I think each of us has superpowers of some sort. And if we got 2 or 3 or 4% of the population that kind of understood the general landscape is like, I'm going to make these changes in my own life. I'm going to do this for my community in Vancouver or in Red Wing, Minnesota. I think that may pay unimaginable dividends if we could have that kind of organization and inspiration going.
Nate, you've produced a lot in the last year or two. There's a peer-reviewed journal paper, one book out in September 2019, another coming, hints of videos and free resources. Where should the beginner go to access your work?
I've been so busy that I haven't really organized it too well, but I will be doing that in the next few months. If you go to energyinourfuture.org, you'll be able to find everything there with a little bit of digging. And there's a 5-hour and a 1-hour series of videos that University of Minnesota freshmen watch, and the entire books and materials for those students will be online for free on that website in the next few months.
Great. And your book is available through Amazon. I looked it up. It wasn't cheap, but it's there, and I think people could find it there too.
It's a textbook. It's very large and has a lot of color in it, which is why it's more expensive. But, yeah, I need to do something about that. I'm not sure what yet.
All right. Well, we got to wrap this up. Is there anything else that we've missed that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
Wow. So you mostly talk about climate, right? And you didn't ask me anything about climate, though I brought it up a few times.
No, I didn't, because I don't only talk about climate. I've been interested in the energy issues and financial issues. I've done a few shows on finances and the possibility of a financial imbalance and that sort of thing. But yeah, about 80% of my shows are on climate change. I think it is, for me, the issue that I focus on.
Well, I think we covered quite a lot. I think we have to remember that we're alive at a very special time. We're getting emotional signals right now that climate change and social inequality are the front burner issues. We're not getting emotional signals that debt and energy and growth and finance are problems, but they're about to become front burner issues. What to tell people? There is so much information and craziness in our lives right now. I think our general reaction, our normal human reaction, is either one of denial or despondency. And I personally expect that things are going to be worse than most people expect, but better than many of us fear. So I advocate steering more people to the winding, narrow, uncertain path that lies between fantasy and doom. We are all alive at an amazing and perilous time. In my experience and opinion, working with young people, reading history, each of you listening to this is capable of so much more than you can imagine at the moment. Be awake, be your best, make a difference on something that matters to you.
Dr. Nate Higgins teaches Reality 101 at the University of Minnesota. His new book is The Bottlenecks of the 21st Century. A second book is coming out soon. His latest paper is The Future of Economics Beyond the Superorganism. And I'll put links to these things by Nate Higgins in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Nate, it is really a pleasure talking with you, even when we managed to escape the dark side and see where we could go.
You're very welcome, Alex. I'll talk to you again at some point.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. The climatic fire catastrophe continues in Australia. While we occupy ourselves with Iran, Brexit, and Trump, the real show is country-sized carbon pouring into the air in the southern hemisphere. Large, very large parts of Australia are burning. The normal peak fire season is yet to come in February. Dozens of Australians have lost their lives already in the fire. Estimates of the number of animals killed have gone past a billion. These wallabies, koalas, and countless species found only in Australia are the innocents. It all breaks my heart, even to speak about the disaster in Australia. We predicted all this in early October in my show titled Burning at the End of the World. My interview with top Australian fire expert Greg Mullins is still worth a listen from my website at ecoshock.org. But now, with the help and urging of my Australian correspondents, we have to tackle it again. That show likely coming out in 2 weeks' time. Meanwhile, here's what Paul Krugman wrote in the New York Times. Quote, "But if a nation in flames isn't enough to produce a consensus for action, if it isn't even enough to produce some moderation in the anti-environmentalist position, what will? The Australian experience suggests that climate denial will persist come hell or high water, that is, through devastating heat waves and catastrophic storm surges alike. But if climate denial and opposition to action are immovable, even in the face of obvious catastrophe, what hope is there for avoiding the apocalypse? Let's be honest with ourselves. Things are looking pretty grim. However, giving up is not an option." End quote from Paul Krugman. Well said. Stay tuned as a new earth develops. See you next week.